You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
To Before They Were Live, an ongoing monthly extremely nerdy conversation through the land of fairy or the perilous realm. In his seminal essay on fairy stories, J.R.R. Tolkien says he has hardly been more than a wandering explorer or trespasser in the land, full of wonder but not of information. We take the same tack. We are, as ever, interested in playing our part in a healthy ecosystem of art, criticism, and fandom, paying attention to the ways stories have shaped our collective imaginations. We are slurpers of soups, happy to ladle out a bowlful from the great cauldron of story that has been bubbling and brewing for centuries. W.H. Auden said, art is our chief means of breaking bread with the dead. So pull up a chair to our table, grab yourself a soup bowl and a big old chunk of homemade bread and help us enrich the reading experience and have some fun too. This is our second episode of Rudyard Kipling's Just So Stories. So hear and attend and listen, for this befell and happened and became and was, oh, my best beloved. And with me to tell these stories is Michael Farmer. Hey, Michael.
Oh, Josh, live forever.
Thank you. You too. So I was noticing this week, last month, we were struggling a little bit, I felt like, in our episode on the first round of these stories. And so I've been thinking about that all month and also reading these stories. And one of the conclusions I've come to is that there are some stories that are made to be retold over and over and over again. And the storyteller, not that the storyteller doesn't matter, because obviously a master storyteller is going to do a better job with any story, but there's stories that can be retold many times and in slightly different ways, slightly different variations. And I feel like those ones are the fun ones to retell. And then there are some stories, like some of these stories, that I think are going to be very difficult to retell. So
have you read An Experiment in Criticism by C.S. Lewis?
No, I probably should, but I've not read that one. No.
He makes this point in that book. Give me just a second. I'm going to go get it and I'm going to read this section.
Okay.
This is from chapter 5 of Lewis's Experiment in Criticism, and he says, there is then a particular kind of story which has a value in itself, a value independent of its embodiment in any literary work. The story of Orpheus strikes and strikes deep of itself. The fact that Virgil and others have told it in good poetry is irrelevant. To think about it and be moved by it is not necessarily to think about those poets or to be moved by them. It is true that such a story can hardly reach us except in words, but this is logically accidental. If some perfected art of mime or silent film or serial pictures could make it clear with no words at all, it would still affect us in the same way. So, like, this is what he's talking about when he talks about myth, is that it's a story whose plot is so effective that it doesn't require any particular skill of the storyteller, which is good news for you and me, because I don't know that we have particular skill as storytellers.
Yeah, or we're honing them at least.
Right. So I feel like that is something of what's happening with these Just So stories. They're less mythological, and maybe that's because they're the product of one mind. Although I don't know that Lewis would like me saying that based on the other things he says in that chapter. Or maybe it's just because the language that Kipling is using is so important to the kind of makeup of the story that maybe when we go back to talk about it, it's just not as effective.
Yeah. So in my version of this book has an introduction by Elizabeth R. Choi. I don't know if I'm saying her name correctly, but it's the foreword to the 1978 edition. And her final paragraph, she says, "The Just So stories are in the storytelling tradition, and Kipling very much intended them to be read aloud. As he said, quote, there is no line of my verse or prose which has not been mouthed till the tongue has made all smooth, and memory, after many recitals, has mechanically skipped the grosser superfluities." If I pronounce that word right, I don't know. "A superbly amusing and entertaining experience, Kipling's Just So stories will delight both young and old alike." So I think that's part of, like, if we were reading these, you know, as they're told, they would be closer to, like, what Kipling wanted, maybe, than just the plot and the story being retold over and over.
I wonder if some of the cutesier elements of these stories feel less annoying when you read them aloud. Because there's almost a house at Pooh Corner quality to some of the language in this book. And I don't mean that as a compliment.
Yeah.
But I've never read Milne out loud either. So I don't know.
Yeah, in preparation for this episode, I read most of these. I didn't get through all of them, but I read most of them aloud to some of my daughters. And so I will say that there was a little bit different feel reading them aloud. And, but still, I mean, and we'll get there when we get there, but like how the alphabet was made, I feel like even reading it aloud, it wasn't there. But anyway, we'll get to that one when we get to that particular story.
Yeah, sounds good.
But it is a different feel reading it with an audience. So, and I'll give you some of the insights that my daughters had on these ones.
I think that's what our listeners really want. I think they really want
what I wish I remembered stuff. Even more of what they said. I really only remember a comment or two. So, if that's what they really want, sorry, you're on the wrong podcast. But you know, email me. Maybe I'll invite you over. You can come talk to my kids.
Yeah, anybody who has the opportunity to go to Josh's homestead should take it.
All right. Well, we got six stories to do today, and the first one is called The Beginning of the Armadillo. Should we jump into that?
Let's do it.
All right. So this story, O Best Beloved, is from the high and far off times. And in those times, there was a hedgehog and a tortoise, and the hedgehog is called Stickly Prickly, and the tortoise is called Slow and Solid. And there was also a painted jaguar and his mother. And the jaguar was learning from his mother how to eat all the different things that could be eaten, because jaguars apparently eat everything, and they'll eat anything they can get hold of. And if he can't catch anything, then he would eat something else. So like if he couldn't eat a monkey, then he'd eat a deer, and if he couldn't eat a frog, then he'd eat a beetle, and so on. So the mother teaches him about how to eat a hedgehog and how to eat a tortoise. And to eat the hedgehog, what you have to do is the hedgehog is going to curl up, and so you have to drop him in the Amazon, and then he'll uncurl, and then you can eat him. And the tortoise, you just have to scoop the meat out of the shell. And so one day, baby jaguar is hungry, and he's at the edge of the Amazon there, and he sees Sticky Prickly and Slow and Solid, and he asks them, he says, "Hey, I know how to eat you guys, but I don't know which of you is a hedgehog and which of you is a tortoise." He's not the brightest cat, this baby jaguar. And so then this is where the storytelling of reading it maybe kicks in a little more, because the way that Sticky Prickly and Slow and Solid trick baby jaguar is by mixing up all the words that his mother has told them. So I'll read a couple passages. They say, "Are you sure of what your mummy told you?" said Sticky Prickly Hedgehog. "Are you quite sure? Perhaps she said that when you uncoil a tortoise, you must shell him out of the water with a scoop, and when you paw a hedgehog, you must drop him on the shell." So they say things like this a few times where they're mixing up all the language. And poor baby Jaguar is terribly confused, and so confused that his spots hurt. And so finally, he decides through the way that they're talking to him that the hedgehog must be the tortoise. And so he tries to scoop the hedgehog out of his shell. And of course, he gets his paw full of prickles. And he's very upset about this. And he whacks the hedgehog away into the bushes where he is safe. And so then he has the tortoise left. And he's, but he's still not certain that this is actually the real tortoise. And tortoise manages to trick him into thinking that he's the hedgehog by saying, well, whatever you do, don't drop me in the water. And so he drops him in the water. And then, of course, tortoise gets away and swims. So now baby Jaguar is very upset, and he goes back to his mother, and she gives him new instructions that he cannot forget these instructions. And that can't curl, but can swim, slow, solid, that's him, curls up, but can't swim, stickly, prickly, that's him. And sticky, prickly, and slow, solid, they overhear this conversation, and they realize that they are in trouble because even baby Jaguar cannot forget this. And so they decide that what needs to happen is Sticky Prickly needs to learn how to swim, and Tortoise needs to learn how to curl. And so because they're friends, they help each other out. Tortoise gives Sticky Prickly some swimming lessons, and Sticky Prickly unlaces the back plates on Slow and Solid's shell until he can curl little bit by little bit. He keeps loosening them up more and more. And after they do this for a whole day, they realize that they are changed, and neither of them is quite like what they were before. And so they're very excited about this, and they say, let's go find Jaguar. And they go, and they find baby Jaguar, and they tease him again, and they say, can't curl, but can swim, Sticky Prickly, that's him, curls up, but can't swim, Slow Solid, that's him. And then they start rolling all around together, and they swim, and he is wildly confused. And so he runs back to his mother, and he says, there's these new animals in the forest, and I don't know what their names are. And she says, well, we'll just call them armadillo until we figure out what they are. And so that's how they got their name, armadillo. And they're very clever. And so there are, you know, there's still tortoises and hedgehogs in other places in the world, but the armadillos are the oldest and the cleverest and the wisest of these animals.
Yeah, this is a funny one, isn't it?
Yeah, it's humorous for sure. And I my daughter said, there's something a little wrong with this story because they were both boys. So where did all the rest of the armadillos come from?
Asexual reproduction, for sure.
Yes.
it's kind of a parable about evolutionary adaptation, right? That it's like the one about the leopard and its spots. It's the idea here is in order to survive, they've had to change their characteristics, and over time they end up kind of morphing into this new species. I don't know that that's exactly how evolution works, but it's kind of a parable about it. And you get the mother who denies that it's possible. She says, a hedgehog is a hedgehog and can't be anything but a hedgehog, and a tortoise is a tortoise and can never be anything else. So she's essentially saying that the species are fixed, and that there's no kind of movement from one species into another species. And, you know, this was a very live debate in 1903. I'm sure a lot of people, I guess some people still believe that today, but evolution was still a relatively new theory in the late 19th century. And so I think he's making fun of that debate a little bit here.
Yeah, it seems like he's got some of that in mind, just, you know, through the character of many of these stories. It seems that the evolutionary debate is in the background. There's also a little bit of just the mix up, the way that children can just get mixed up about things, you know, like the way that they tease the baby Jaguar and get him all mixed up in his head. And, you know, they feel like one thing is true, but their memories aren't quite perfect. I mean, as no human's memory is quite perfect, right? And so they can easily get confused about which is which and what is what. So, yeah, there's
right,
a little bit of that also.
the way they trick him is they give him this incredible barrage of false information, right? Like they just make his head spin by giving him all these lies. And then what's interesting to me is eventually the turtle just starts telling him the truth. But
That's right.
A tortoise, said Slow and Solid. Your mother was quite right. She said that you were to scoop me out of my shell with your paw. Begin. So it's like he's been told so many lies in such a rapid fire motion that the truth itself becomes a kind of lie. I feel like Painted Jaguar might be the first resident of the internet age.
Yeah, that's the this is definitely a story for our time in that way. Because yeah, you're right. There's so much there's too much information, and you're right. That's the sinisterness of when there's lies all about and you can't quite tell the truth from the lies, is that then, you know, the truth can just as easily be disbelieved as any lie can. So, oh, yeah. Epistemological crisis for poor baby jaguar.
Yeah, you hate to root for the predator.
Yeah, in general, you don't in these types of stories, right? You know, the predators generally aren't the ones that get rooted for, but there is a little bit of, you feel a little bad for him. He definitely gets spun all around and in many different ways. So,
did you look to see if there's any kind of like actual evolutionary connection between armadillos, hedgehogs, and turtles? Turtles are reptiles, so whatever connection there is between them and armadillos is going to go way back. But what about hedgehogs?
Yeah, I don't really know. I'm probably a little closer to Jaguar's mother in this in this particular debate, you know. So I don't know about how all the tree of life connects one to another.
It looks like the closest they have in common is the class, which is mammalia. So yeah, they're both mammals. That's not terribly interesting.
Yeah, the same thing that we are too. So.
They kind of have similar faces. They have like kind of rodent faces, I guess. I don't know. Armadillos kind of look like pigs. I don't know. They're disgusting.
Oh. Yeah, I think. I don't know that I've ever seen an armadillo in real life.
Really? So. You've never seen one like smashed on the side of the road?
Oh, maybe. Yeah, I guess we do have a few around here that get. I think they've been working their way. I think I saw a news article about this, like probably a year ago, that they've been working their way farther and farther north, and so you were seeing them more and more, I think.
That's interesting. Is it like a climate change thing? It's warmer everywhere, so the
armadillo. Yeah, maybe. I honestly couldn't tell you. I probably shouldn't have even said that because I really don't. Somebody's gonna write or somebody's gonna be like, "What are you talking about? Armadillos have always lived in South Carolina." And so.
You know, I read that
actually, according to Kipling, they're from the Amazon, so there.
I read that they are one of the few animals other than human beings who can get leprosy.
Oh,
so be careful touching the armadillos. Maybe that too is an adaptation that Stickly Prickly and Slow Steady developed in order to get rid of Painted Jaguar. Maybe they're just trying to give him leprosy so he'll leave him alone.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, I am happy for armadillos to move up here, but I would not like it if there were jaguars living in my area. So, armadillos, you are welcome, but we'll leave Painted Jaguar down in the Amazon.
given you and your family's love for cats, you'd think having such a sleek, beautiful apex predator walking around Greenville would really appeal to you.
Yeah. Until it drops out of a tree onto your back, and yeah, that's the end of you.
Well, let's move on to how the first letter was written. So this is one of, I think in our editions, two stories featuring this Neolithic family. I think there are actually two other ones that don't get included in a lot of editions, but
these were the only two in my edition. I didn't know that there were more, so.
But the family consists of Tugami Bopsalai, which means man who does not put his foot forward in a hurry. And then his wife, Teshumai Tawindra, which means lady who asks a very many questions. And their daughter, Tafamai metalumai, which means small person without any manners who ought to be spanked. But Kipling and we are just going to call them Tugamai, Tashumai, and Taffy for short. So Taffy is very devoted to her father, as I assume Effie Kipling was very devoted to her father. And one day, the two of them have gone to spear carp for dinner, and Tegumai's spear accidentally breaks, and they're a long way from home, and he doesn't have any extra spears, and they get to talking about how great it would be if they could get Teshumai to send them their spear, and how what a big shame it is that they can't write, which is already a little bit strange because the story is called How the First Letter Was Written. So how do they know that writing is a possibility if they're going to write the first letter? But whatever. at just this moment, a stranger comes from a different tribe. They're called the Tawaras. And he doesn't speak their language, and they don't speak his language. But Taffy, nevertheless, tries to get this guy to go to get her dad's other spear, the one with the black handle, and bring it back to the river so Tugamai can use it to spearfish. But again, like, they can't actually communicate because they don't speak the same language. So the stranger takes a piece of white birch bark and gives it to her, and she's going to draw on it. She uses a shark's tooth from the guy's necklace to draw a picture of what she wants him to do. Since you say it's the language is important, I'm just going to read this section. First, I'll draw Daddy fishing. It isn't very like him, but Mommy will know because I've drawn his spear all broken. Well, now I'll draw the other spear that he wants, the black-handled spear. It looks as if it was sticking in Daddy's back, but that's because the shark's tooth slipped and this piece of bark isn't big enough. That's the spear I want you to fetch, so I'll draw a picture of me myself splaining to you. My hair doesn't stand up like I've drawn, but it's easier to draw that way. Now I'll draw you. I think you're nice, really, but I can't make you pretty in the picture, so you mustn't be fended. Are you fended? Look, now I've drawn you and I've put the spear that Daddy wants into your hand just to remind you that you're to bring it. Now I'll show you how to find my mummy's living address. You go along till you come to those two trees. Those are trees. Then you'll go over a hill. That's a hill. And then you'll come into a beaver swamp all full of beavers. I haven't put in the beavers because I can't draw beavers, but I've drawn their heads, and that's all you'll see of them when you cross the swamp. Mind you, don't fall in. Then our cave is just beyond the beaver swamp. It isn't as high as the hills, really, but I can't draw things very small. That's my mummy outside. She's beautiful. She's the most beautifulest mummy there ever was, but she won't be offended when she sees I've drawn her so plain. She'll be pleased of me because I can draw. Now, in case you forget, I've drawn the spear that Daddy wants outside our cave. It's inside, really, but you show the picture to my mummy and she'll give it to you. I've made her holding up her hands because I know she'll be so pleased to see you. Isn't it a beautiful picture? Of course, the stranger understands none of this because she is speaking a language he doesn't understand, and her drawings, as she repeatedly points out, aren't terribly realistic. So we have this total failure of communication that is then compounded when he just happens to stumble across their home and gives the birch bark to Taffy's mother, who is having a meeting of Neolithic ladies. And when she looks at the birch bark, she completely misreads the situation because the drawing is so bad. And she thinks that that Taffy is telling her that this man has attacked Tagami, and is threatening her as well. And so the entire tribe shows up at the stream to rescue Tagami, who doesn't need to be rescued at all because nothing has happened. And they all feel bad about the way they've treated the stranger. And so they end up letting him into their tribe. And in the meantime, they have learned how to send letters. But the head chief says, next time you write a picture letter, you'd better send a man who can talk our language with it to explain what it means. And that's how the first letter was written.
Yeah, this is another one that's it's really funny.
This one, it really is. And she seems like a real kid.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think that is one of, we talked about this a little bit last time with Kipling's, his captions on his pictures are like just these running commentaries that are very much like a kid drew it. And this is like just taking the captions that are on the pictures to another level of both humor and just childlikeness. So I don't know if you've ever sat with a child who's drawing a picture and have them kind of talk to you about what they're drawing as they do it, but it's very, very much like the way
they does it. It does have to be interpreted.
Yeah. Yeah. And then not only does it have to be interpreted, it's impossible to interpret if you're not there, if you're not right with the child, because, you know, they haven't learned so many things yet about, you know, the way that we compose things and, you know, the way to make things.
Right.
Make sense.
Isn't that interesting? Because they don't have like the muscle strength or the talent yet, as most of us will never get the talent to draw it photorealistically. So you could actually just see what it's supposed to be. But they also are not old enough to have learned the conventions about what represents what. So yes, they're kind of making up their own language as they go, which I think is what I find so interesting about this one and the next one, is it's trying to give us a picture, you know, not a realistic picture, obviously, of the beginnings of human communication. So you have this new form of communication that is totally built on a miscommunication, just a failure to communicate. And that's what allows for this new form of communication. And then the punchline at the end is, if you're going to communicate with this new form of communication, well, you'd better have somebody there to interpret it. So like, it's totally worthless without the speech there that will make it clear what it's supposed to mean.
That's right.
And then the additional layer of this is that the original audience of this story, F.E. Kipling, gets it as oral communication. The rest of us are getting it through the medium that the story itself undermines by saying you've got to have an interpreter there to tell you what it actually means. And we don't have an interpreter. We don't get to ask Kipling questions about it.
That's right. And interrupt him and, ask. Yeah.
I this rarely happens to me, Josh, but as I read this story and the one after it, all I could think was, boy, I wish Jacques Derrida were here to talk about this, because I feel like he could make a field day out of it. Now, I mean, maybe he has talked about it, but I'm not really willing to dig through Derrida to try to find out if he said anything about Kipling. And if he did, I probably wouldn't understand what he was saying anyway. But this seems very ahead of its time in terms of the view of what language and interpretation are. Mm-hmm. That I really did get excitingly grad school flashbacks reading this story and the next one, which is kind of a sequel to it. Takes place in a week.
Sure. Yeah. Do you have an inkling of what Derrida would say?
Well, it's more about the next one than this one, but this idea that this tool of communication needs to be interpreted, Derrida would say, well, doesn't the interpretation also need to be interpreted? And doesn't that interpretation also need to be interpreted? And you get this endless deferral of the appropriate interpretation of the thing you're talking about. Like you think about the thing she's drawn, everybody interprets it in a different way, including her. And so you get this, ultimately, this thing that is completely uninterpretable, or this thing that has an abundance of interpretations, and those two things come to the same thing. Interpretation only makes sense if there's a limited number of true ones, whereas if you have a limitless number of interpretations, you may as well have no meaning whatsoever, right? You know, like pure nonsense is endlessly interpretable. It can mean whatever you want it to mean.
Yeah.
For it to have meaning, there have to be limits. And I'm trying to think of how to say this without, like, I'm not a Derridian, and it's been a long time since I read Derrida. So if Nathan Gilmore, somebody else who likes Derrida more than I do, is listening, feel free to tell me I've got it wrong. But Derrida would say there essentially is no master text. There's only the interpretation. We're all just endlessly interpreting this birch bark, but there is no actual meaning to any of it beyond the meanings we give it.
You know, but what I find interesting about that is, like, and maybe this is just coincidence, I don't know, but like I feel like the way that the mother interprets it is like a very like it made sense to me, you know, like the like she draws her hair all standing up because it's easier to draw that way. But then when the mother sees it, she says, look, her hair, like, he says, here's my Tagumai with his arm broken. Here's a spear sticking into his back. Here's a man with a spear ready to throw. Here's another man throwing a spear from a cave. And here are a whole pack of people, which they were really Taffy's beavers, but they did look rather like people, coming up behind Tagumai. Isn't it shocking?
But
that wasn't the part I wanted. Here it is. Sorry, I was reading the wrong part. He says, he has stuck my Tagumai all full of spears and frightened poor Taffy so that her hair stands all on end, which is the convention, right? Like if somebody's hair is all standing up, they're afraid. So you're saying like there's no conventions yet, but you know, even within that, like there is some convention that she's interpreting.
She's not aware. Taffy's not aware of the conventions, so she's flying blind. She's like making her own language that nobody else can speak, except it's close enough to somebody else's language that everything she draws is a false friend for another symbol. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. Does your copy of the book have the picture in it?
It does, but it's really hard to...
mine too. Like I'm shining a light on it right now and I can just barely see it. And you can see that there's a spear in the guy's back and it looks like Taffy's head is on fire.
Yeah. It reminds me, have you ever played the game, the telephone Pictionary game?
No.
Oh, it's a great game. So if anybody ever wants to play it, it's a great party game. So you all sit in a circle and you have a stack of papers, and on the first paper you write a sentence, and then everybody writes a sentence on their first paper, and then everybody passes the paper, and you look at the sentence that is written, and then you put that on the bottom of the stack, and then on your fresh clean piece of paper on top you draw a picture of that sentence, and then everybody passes that paper, and so then you have to look at that picture and interpret it, and then you put that onto the bottom and you write a sentence of what you think that picture is, and then so it goes back and forth between picture and language all the way around the circle until it gets back to the original person, and then when they get it back, then you can read and see the ridiculous transformations that happen from your original sentence to the last through the pictures and the way that people interpret the pictures that were drawn. And it's a very funny
that sounds like so game. Much fun.
Yes, so maybe it was invented. Maybe this is a little bit how that game was invented.
Well, and I feel like all new communications technology introduces all these possibilities for misunderstanding.
Mm-hmm.
Think about the way you don't hear people talk like this anymore, but think about the way when the internet was new, people would first of all, you would get this trope where the hot chick you thought you were talking to on the internet was really a, you know, middle-aged man.
Yeah.
Which is a joke you never hear anymore. But, it was a joke that was made possible by the fact that certain parts of the communication were not available, right? It abstracted certain things. But then also, people always used to say you can't communicate sarcasm over the internet.
Mm-hmm.
Which I feel like we've largely figured out a way to communicate sarcasm over the internet, but in the early days there weren't there were all these opportunities for misunderstanding, and I feel like that's what happens with all new communications technologies until a new semiotics of communication develop around that technology.
Mm-hmm.
You just learn you don't learn the conventions because the conventions didn't exist until they existed. And so in the early days of using whatever it is, you know, the meanings didn't really exist, but, you know, 15, 20 years later, after everybody's been using it for a while, the conventions are there and nobody miscommunicates in that way anymore.
Yeah, they kind of, the conventions kind of, they kind of emerge out of it, you know, in their own way. That is really fascinating to think about the way that different social conventions, you know, just kind of emerge from, like, nobody's setting out necessarily to create them, but they just kind of get created.
Yeah, and I mean, those things change too. Think about the difference in chat rooms in Web 1.0 and Web 2.0. Think about the number of times you use chat rooms, right, when you were in high school.
Oh yeah.
Think about how you would use joke HTML in those chat rooms. So like the one way people would try to communicate sarcasm is they would do like HTML sarcasm, HTML into sarcasm.
Right. Yeah.
And that was like us trying to like groping around for what the conventions would be, and those ended up not being the conventions. And if you did that now, teenagers would look at you like you didn't, like you were speaking a foreign language, which I guess in a certain way you would be.
Yeah, because you're speaking a code that they don't know.
Right. And I just feel like I feel like communications technology lends itself to this. If you try to use the rules of an older form of communication with one of these newer forms, it's all going to seem like nonsense, you know, which is why at a certain age you lose your ability. Like I cannot imagine wanting to use TikTok or like wanting to figure out how it works. I've passed the age where I want to take on a new technology like that. Or we were just talking, we've been recording on Skype because we're in our 40s. But when I logged on to Skype this evening, it said that they're discontinuing Skype, and now I'm going to have to learn how to use Teams. And I'm sure that the conventions on Teams are going to be different. Not that I use Skype. I don't use any of the like built-ins for Skype. So maybe that's not a good example. I don't know. Yeah.
No, it is. It's, you know, people our age will get this and the other people will not. But, you know, when we were kids, the convention for people like us now, right, like having to learn new technology and not quite getting it, not knowing how to do it, is the blinking 12 o'clock on the VCR, right?
It sure was.
And I remember at the time even thinking like, oh, I wonder, like, someday am I going to reach a point where I've got the blinking 12 o'clock, you know, like in whatever sense it is, you know? And yes, I have reached that age. I have the blinking 12 o'clock on, you know, on being able to use TikTok or keeping up with, you know, just modern internet life.
We've gone far afield from the story, but I have to tell the story. I took some students a few years ago on a field trip on like a Saturday. We went to a library to do some research. Anyway, we stop and eat lunch, and I ask the kids if I can take a picture of them all. And there's too many to fit in the screen of the camera the way I know how to use it. And one of them tells me to turn on the Fliberty Glam or whatever. You know, I don't know what it's called, because if I knew what it was called, I would know how to use it. And I had to get her to show it to me. And as I handed her my phone, she said something that has chilled me ever since. Old people don't know how to do anything. And I thought, oh my God, I'm an old person.
Yeah. Well, there are some things that are not worth knowing.
I'm Taffy's mom.
There you go. Yeah. Well, that was fun. All right. Well, let's get to the sequel, because there's more of this to come with the next one, which is How the Alphabet Was Made. And this one, I really feel like to even try and retell it is just going to be too boring. So I'm going to really more summarize than retell the story.
This is not really a story.
Yeah. And then if there's parts that we want to add in our discussion, we'll add them in. But basically, it's the week after all the events of the last one. And Taffy has this idea that she can invent symbols in order to communicate, because she's recognized from her previous mistake, which which her father teases her about endlessly throughout this whole story, and she keeps asking him not to, which is one of the more amusing parts of the story, at least to a father, about how her symbols all went awry last time. So she asks her father to make a noise, and so he does. He makes an aw sound, and that reminds her of a carp because of his the shape that his mouth makes when he makes that aw sound. And so she draws a carp, but she can't draw the whole carp, so she just draws the mouth, and then the father Tagumai adds in the feeler, and it looks pretty much like an A at that point. And as they experiment with these, she asks him to make more sounds, and she makes more pictures. But as they draw the pictures over and over to try and remember them, they become more and more simple, and more like letters. And so then the next day they think of more letters, and they're laughing, and they're enjoying their time together, and they're drawing them in the smoke, and then it's so on and so forth and so following till they had done and drawn all the sound pictures they wanted, and there was the alphabet all complete. So that's basically the idea.
Yeah. And I'll say before we start talking about this that friend of the show, Melton McManorberry of the National Anthems podcast, specifically told me how interminable he found how the alphabet was made.
Yeah, this one, I agree with him. I felt like it was really slow, and they went over every single letter, you know, in the same way that I explained the A and the carp. They did that with nearly every letter in the alphabet, and it's just very slow going. And there were moments of humor, but a lot of it is lost, especially if you don't have the pictures. There's little illustrations all the way through this one. But I will say that I was reading, and I closed it, so I don't know where it is, but it's on Google Books. I was just looking for something that, like, criticism about Kipling, to try and give me more insight in what to say, since I had so little last week. And the person who wrote that text felt like this was the best of the Just So stories. And I was like, what?
I think you would have to have a PhD in English to think this was the best of the Just So. Because I also, like, it's not a great story. But it also excited me in a way that some of these other ones I thought, oh, that's cute. But this one, it really got me thinking about what there was to say about it, whereas some of them, I'm not sure I really had anything to say about them.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, again, I'm thinking in kind of Derridian terms. This idea, he says, so if they write the word yo, which means bad water, they could scratch it in the side of a pool in the beaver swamp, but I needn't be near the water at all. I might be miles away hunting, and still it would be just the same as if you stood there and said, "Goya taffy, or you'll get fever." So, like, there's this notion that writing allows absence. You no longer have to be present to be present, which is, like, a thing that literary theorists say about what writing is. Like, Plato says this in the Phaedrus, all the way back to the Phaedrus. And this is where Derrida came in for me, because Derrida talks about this it's not of grammatology, it's the other way, it doesn't matter, in whatever his first big book was in the 1960s, that writing is a kind of artificial presence, and they're very excited about it, and Derrida is very excited about it. Plato hates this, or at least Socrates hates it. I mean, in the Phaedrus, he talks about how, like, this is the evil thing about writing, is there's no way to respond to what somebody says, because what appears to be presence is really just absence. And so, like, I won't say it's a good story, but it is a story that I would have loved to have brought into a literary theory class back before I took high school. Because there are so many things he's saying that are so theoretically, at least, interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. And I do think it is there when you say it that way. I understand your excitement. You're an excellent communicator and educator, Michael, because I can even in this terrible absence of one another and this mediation, like, we're not, you know, for people who don't know, we don't record with our cameras on because it messes up our bandwidth and stuff. So I'm hearing Michael's voice just the same as you are. But there is a sense of, you know, the passion that you have for this that comes through. And so, yeah, I'd love to take a class from you, Michael, on this sort of thing.
Thank you, Josh.
But I mean that very sincerely.
But yeah, I mean, it's not a great story. It's not like interesting for the most part on its own terms, but it is interesting for the kind of view of writing that it presents. Also, I mean, you know, the alphabet is a very late evolution in writing. So you begin with pictograms and ideograms and stuff like that, hieroglyphics. And if you look, you can see how there are diagrams you can find online that'll show you how those things evolve into the alphabet. And it's actually not much different than this. Like it is kind of true that things begin as a picture of something and then over time get abstracted into the letters, which then become sounds instead of words. So that's, you know, kind of cool. It's not exactly the way they say it's happening, in part because they're skipping the intermediate steps, but it is fun to see that kind of linguistic evolution on display here, just like the biological evolution is on display in some of the other stories.
Yeah. And I think that part actually is one of the things that frustrated me about this story, because with the well, partly because of my views on evolution, but also like just because like I don't think that's the way a camel got its hump, or I don't think that's the way an armadillo really came about. But like it doesn't really matter to me. Like it's not like it's just a funny story, and there's maybe more of a, like with the camel, like maybe there's more of a moral or something to it. Whereas with this one, it's like, well, this is nonsense, but like there's like probably some element of truth, like you were saying about like this is how letters came about. But I'd much rather spend the time on like that would be really interesting to me to actually know, like, oh, where did, you know, did the shape of an S come from the fact that somebody made the a snake sound, and then they thought, oh, that looks, you know, kind of like a, like that would be interesting if it were true. But like, you know, the letters and our pronunciations of them have obviously evolved over time, and, you know, different languages use similar symbols, but, you know, for different sounds. So like, this is obviously just nonsense. And I think the true story would be much more interesting. And I guess it bothered me in this one. It bothered me more than, you know, the story of how a camel got its hump or whatever.
More interesting to you, but probably not more interesting for a 5-year-old. I would think that this might be a way to get a kid interested in the evolution of language and writing.
Sure, fair enough. Yeah, fair enough.
I mean, this shouldn't substitute for actually learning about how languages evolve.
Right. Yeah, I'm not the target audience. Maybe that's fair enough. Although my kids, I tried to read this one aloud to my kids, and they were like not following. You know, like it was a hard one. Even, you know, with them sitting next to me and seeing the pictures and stuff, this was just a hard one to get through.
Yeah. So. No. Well, yeah. It is as a story, it is not a great story. You actually might be better off reading them a book on the history of linguistics.
Yeah.
One thing I did think was interesting, though, is, so as far as we can tell, writing was invented for two purposes. One is to keep track of trade. So I'm trading you 5 bushels of barley for 3 pieces of lapis lazuli or whatever. And, you know, eventually your trade reaches a level of complexity that you can't just use scratch marks anymore. Mm-hmm. And so that's one thing writing was invented for. The other seems to have been for religious rituals. The priests were the ones who learned to write first. And one of the interesting things about the story is that one of the first things that Tagumai and Taffy do with their alphabet is they make a magical necklace with all the letters on it. And I think especially in the late 19th century, that would have been very, very in line with the way people thought about the history of writing. I mean, I don't know that. I haven't read any late 19th century books on linguistic history, but I bet you anything that was a majority view of the like James Frazer Golden Bough crowd, where, you know, it's some sort of mono myth that everything is going back to, like the structural view of human mythology. But I don't know, because I haven't read any of that stuff.
Yeah. But that's clearly something that Kipling is playing around with. Like, maybe not that specific thing that you said, but, like he's obviously extremely educated, you know? Like even here at the end, he says, after thousands and thousands and thousands of years, and after hieroglyphics and demotics and nihilitics and cryptics and Qfix and runics and dorics and ionics and all sorts of other ricks and tricks, because the wounds and the neguses and the akuns and the repositories of traditions would never leave a good thing alone when they saw it, the fine, old, easy, understandable alphabet. And so, like, when he writes that, like, there's, like, I know the word hieroglyphic, and I know of, I have some memory of learning about Dorics and Ionics at some point, you know, but like, for the most part, I honestly can't tell like how much of this is just like stuff that he's making up and how much is like real things that he's pulling in, but it seems real.
Yeah. I know that neguses are a thing. Runics are like runes, Scandinavian.
Oh yeah. Yeah. That makes sense. Right? Yeah.
I don't know if Dorics and Ionics are forms of writing or not. I think of those as like all orders of columns in Greek architecture.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Like I've heard the words. I don't know if they have.
But you know, basically the only English class I ever didn't get an A in was history of the English language. Like linguistics are not something I have any particular talent for. So I've never studied them in any detail.
Yeah. But to your point there, I think there's a way that is really interesting where he's got this vast sort of knowledge, and he's amusing himself as he amuses his daughter in telling these stories. Yeah. You know what I mean?
And he takes the 1,000-year evolution of hieroglyphics into an alphabet, and he condenses it into an afternoon, like Superman making a diamond out of coal by squeezing it really hard. Like that's the gag, linguistically speaking.
Yeah. And it's so there, I, even though I don't quite get it, I do have an admiration for it. I'll say that.
But I suspect many of our readers, our listeners, will not have gotten to the end of the story, because it is fairly boring as a story.
Unless you love this stuff. And so.
And even I didn't love it as a story. Again, I just enjoyed having the opportunity to think about that stuff for the first time in a while.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about the crab that played with the sea.
Okay. I love this one.
Yeah, I do too. So back in the earliest days of the universe, when the eldest magician was getting things ready, he called all the animals to him and he told them to play at being what they are. And so the elephant would go and play with digging with his tusk and stamping with his feet. And that's how the Himalayas were created. And there's a whole series of these. This animal will pretend to be itself, and in being itself will create part of the world with the aid of the eldest magician, which is a really lovely, which is a really lovely image. So eventually the eldest magician runs into man and he says, hey, man, are all the animals obedient to you? And man says, yeah. And he says, what about the earth? And the man says, yeah. And he says, what about the sea? And the man says, no. In fact, once a day and once a night, the sea overflows its bounds and goes into my house and gets everything wet. And sometimes it'll while I'm riding in my canoe down the river, the waters will recede and just leave me sitting there in the mud in the canoe. Is that what you told the ocean to do? And the eldest magician says, absolutely not. I didn't know that was happening. Let's figure out what's going on. And they interview some people. There's a guy with a fishing line who's making the tides come in and out. And there's a rat that lives in the moon for some reason. But it's the man's daughter who figures out what's actually going on, which is while the eldest magician was telling all these animals what to do, one animal, the crab, ran away from him and went off into the sea before the eldest magician had told him what to do. And the crab's name is Pau Ama. And it turns out that Pau Ama, whenever he leaves his cave, the sea expands and goes out and floods the man's house and does a whole bunch of other stuff. And Pau Ama had no idea that these things were happening, but he's so flattered by the idea that he's so important that he decides instead of doing it once a day, he's going to do it seven times a day. And nobody wants this to happen because it would be terribly destructive. But the eldest magician can't do anything about it because now that everything's been put in order, the eldest magician can't actually make Pau Ama do anything he wants him to do. So the only thing Pau Ama is really able to do, he's very proud of himself, but the only thing he's really able to do is to stir up the sea. And so the eldest magician, in order to mock him a little bit about this, he takes his shell off of him, and he's now Pau Ama is soft and helpless, and all he wants to go do is hide. And he doesn't feel like he has any place to hide that is safe. And so Pau Ama and the little girl, or I'm sorry, the eldest magician and the little girl come up with a solution, which is that she's got a pair of scissors and she's going to give it to Pau Ama and he's going to be able to use it to defend himself and to crack coconuts open and eat them and all that stuff. Even so, Pau Ama would like to have his shell back. And the eldest magician agrees to let him have his shell back 11 months out of the year. But the other month he has to be soft-shelled and helpless just so he doesn't get too full of himself. The man is very satisfied with this. And he is a little bit annoyed at the eldest magician that the eldest magician did all this when Pau Ama was at his house instead of when he was away, so that now the man is going to have to get himself back home. And the eldest magician says, "You were lazy, so your children shall be lazy. They shall be the laziest people in the world. They shall be called the Malazi, the lazy people." And he held his finger up to the moon and said, "Oh, fisherman, here is this man too lazy to row home. Pull his canoe home with your line, fisherman." But the fisherman refuses to do that. The man refuses to allow this and says that the sea is going to have to do the job for him twice a day. And the eldest magician says, "Fine." And that's where we get the tides being controlled by the moon for all this time. So we've got kind of a twofer here. We've got the question of why the crab goes a month without his shell. And we have the question of why the tides come in and out every day.
Yeah, I think this one might be my favorite. It's at least in my top, you know, I mean, there's only 12 of them, but it's, you know, of the ones that we've discussed so far, I think it's my favorite. I just really love I'm not saying that we should take any of this as gospel truth, you know, but like this view of the playful kind of God, and a God who sets everything like his command to all the animals is just go play, go be yourself in your play. It's very like
Chestertonian.
Chestertonian.
It does feel kind of Chestertonian.
I've got a quote from Chesterton, if you will let me hear it. It says, "Because children have abounding vitality, because they are in spirit fierce and free, therefore they want things repeated and unchanged. They always say, 'Do it again.' And the grown-up person does it again until he is nearly dead. For grown-up people are not strong enough to exult in monotony. But perhaps God is strong enough to exult in monotony. It is possible that God says every morning, 'Do it again,' to the sun, and every evening, 'Do it again,' to the moon. It may not be automatic necessity that makes all daisies alike. It may be that God makes every daisy separately, but has never got tired of making them. It may be that he has the eternal appetite of infancy, for we have sinned and grown old, and our father is younger than we." And I don't know, I just got that resonance in this story of God is just a very playful God, and even his punishments, you know, toward the the crab are not as much punishments as, you know, there's natural consequences, but, you know, it's still, there's still a playfulness, or even like towards the man, you know, like the man is too lazy, and God just kind of laughs about it. And it's like, okay, well, we'll make the tides then, you know, like,
fine,
I'll just go with it, you know? And obviously, you know, like that, like I said, don't take this as your orthodoxy, but I do feel like it's a nice balance to maybe the more, you know, God, you know, fire and brimstone God that a lot of us have in our minds time.
I really like the idea that the animals are the agents of the creation of the world, that like the Himalayas come from the elephant cooperating in what the eldest magician tells them to do.
Yes. Yeah. You say more about that. I'm in complete agreement. That was the second part of the story that I just love, is that cooperation between God and his creation. I love it.
What made me think of the Tolkienian idea of sub-creation from On Fairy Stories.
Oh yeah.
What the artist does is kind of creating with the tools that God has given him to create. So it's not the same thing as what God does, but it's kind of a minor version of it within that larger creation. And that's what I see going on here with the other animals. And it would be fun to sit down and think about what all the other animals played at doing and what that created. And then you also get the kind of tall tale aspect of that, right? Mm-hmm. Paul Bunyan creating the 10,000 Lakes of Minnesota with his giant shoes. Or whatever, you know, the idea that these natural things we're looking at weren't in fact created by thousands of years of very slow motion, but were created by some form of absurdist joy.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing, maybe to go back to what we were talking about at the very beginning of the episode about, like, what, you know, when is it a myth that can be retold, and when is it, you know, a story that needs a particular storyteller and particular language and stuff. Like, there's a scope for the imagination in this one, you know, like you can take the ideas that he gives here, and you could, you know, depending on the storyteller, you could, like you said, you could endlessly expand them into all different ways about what different animals were doing, and how they were doing it, and how they played at being a, you know, how the hippopotamus played at being a hippopotamus and ended up creating whatever, you know. And so yeah, it's really fun. It's a very, very fun story.
Yeah, I like it too. And it feels ancient in a way that some of these others don't. Like, this feels like, and maybe we're just saying the same thing, that this one does feel like a myth. It feels like it's arising from the collective unconscious in mm-hmm. a way that a lot of these other stories don't. And one place I see that is this site of the, like, the sea is the one thing that human beings can't control. It's the site of chaos.
Yeah. Which is,
like, that's just a universal condition in ancient folklore and mythology and everything else, right down to the Bible, right? The sea is the site of chaos. That's why it's important in the book of Job that God has tamed the Leviathan.
Yeah. Or that even at the, you know, in the very beginning in Genesis, that he's, you know, he's hovering over the waters, and out of the waters, he brings the order, you know, and he begins all his creation there. So, yeah. In total agreement with you there, Michael. That was, and it's clear that, again, like, you know, Kipling is drawing on his knowledge of all that too, in some way. So that was a really good one.
Good stuff.
I if you're only going to read one, what's this one called?
The crab that played with the sea.
The crab that played with the sea. That's embarrassing. If you're only going to read one, wait, what's the title? Yeah. The crab that played with the sea is definitely a contender for the one you should read, I would say. I think this one's a great one. I came across a picture book version of How the Camel Got Its Hump, and it was just like somebody had taken the story, and it's told exactly like Kipling, but it's a picture book, you know, like there's illustrations all the way through it. And I don't know if there's a whole series of those or not, you know, like I ran across it. I didn't do any research, but if there's not a picture book version of this one, I feel like this one would make a great picture book too. So somebody should make it.
Be the change you want to see in the world, Josh.
That's right. yeah. I liked it at the end too. It says the crabs hide and we should be careful of them when they're without their shells because it isn't their fault that their ancestor was stupid and rude. I feel like there's a little bit of that too for, you know, just sometimes we all suffer because of our ancestors, but it's not our fault. It's not all entirely our fault.
Well, I got to read your favorite. You can read my favorite, The Cat That Walked By Himself.
Yeah. This one is also definitely a contender for one of the best. This one takes place. Let me flip my page here. It's again at the beginnings of all things, but I like how he starts his stories. Hear and attend and listen, for this befell and behappened and became and was, oh my best beloved, when the tame animals were wild, and the dog was wild, and the horse was wild, and the cow was wild, and the sheep was wild, and the pig was wild, as wild could be, and they walked in the wet, wild woods by their wild lones. But the wildest of them all, of all the wild animals, was the cat. He walked by himself, and all places were alike to him. And the man was also wild, but he gets tamed pretty much immediately in the story by the woman. She makes him a dry cave so he doesn't have to sleep in wet leaves. And
ain't that how it is? She makes him sleep in the cave instead of out with the wet leaves.
That's right.
We've both been married for a long time, Josh. That seems right, doesn't it?
And makes him a great dinner, and you know, so everything's good for the man. And then she sat by the fire, she combs her hair, and she makes the first singing magic. And the animals, they notice that something is happening in this cave, and they decide that they're going to go check it out. And the dog is the one who's kind of tasked to go examine it, and he asks the cat to go with him, and the cat refuses. And so that's why dogs and cats are enemies forever. But as the dog leaves to bravely go to the cave, the cat goes behind secretly. And in all of these different animals, as they come to the cave, they always greet the woman as their enemy, and the wife of their enemy. And she always greets them, wild thing, what do you want? And the dog, of course, smells the bones from the dinner. And so she gives him a bone, and then he asks for another one. And she says, if you will help my husband, my man to hunt, or my husband to hunt, then I'll give you all the bones you want. And the dog agrees with this and changes his saying from, oh enemy, to oh friend, and wife of my master. And the cat says, this dog is terribly foolish, and he takes off. And so then the next night, the woman cuts some fresh grass, and she has that out, and she does her singing magic again. And the horse is wondering, man, what happened to dog? He left last night and he never came back. And so the horse goes up there to find out what happened to dog, and gets the grass, and same thing, he wants more. And the woman says, well, if you'll serve us, and if you'll wear this bridle, then I'll give you all the grass you want. And he agrees, and they becomes a friend. And the next day, the same thing with the cow, and the cow comes and offers its milk. And so she basically tames all these different animals, but not the cat. So finally, the cat comes traipsing by, and feels like the woman has proved herself to be very clever, although not as clever as himself, and the animals have all proved themselves to be very foolish. But he wants, he appreciates, although he wants to walk alone, he appreciates that the warmth that the fire seems to offer, and the milk that the cow has made available, and just the warmth of the cave. And so he asks if he can come in, but the woman says, sorry, I've braided my hair, I've put away my magic, and we have no more need of any friends or servants. But the cat cleverly makes a bargain with her and gets her to say if she says one kind word towards him, he can enter the cave, and two kind words, he can sit by the fire, and then three, then he may drink the milk forever and always. So the cat goes away, bides his time, and eventually a baby is born, and the baby is fussy and gripey, as babies tend to be, and the woman is very tired, and she sets him outside the cave trying to get some work done, and the cat comes by, and he plays with the baby and cuddles with the baby and soothes the baby. And the woman is inside. She doesn't know why the baby has stilled. But the bat tells her that there's a wild animal that has played with her baby. And she says blessings upon that animal. And when that happens, the cloth that's covering the cave entrance falls, and the cat is welcome to come in. And so she is angry about this, and she bites her lip, and she's determined not to say a second kind thing about the baby, about the cat. I'm sure she says plenty of kind things about her baby. So then a little time passes. The baby is fussy again, and she's trying to get her, she's making, spooling thread. We've learned before about how women love spooling. And she's doing that, and the cat says, listen, if you throw that thread down on the floor, I can make the baby laugh. And as any of us who have seen a cat and a spool of thread will know, that is very entertaining. And so she does it, and the cat plays in front of the baby, and the baby laughs and smiles, and then afterwards purrs and cuddles up with the baby and puts the baby to sleep. So she is forced to say a second kind word. And when this happens, the smoke that is in the cave all rushes out as a sign that he has gotten the right to sit by the fire. And then finally, now she's really determined not to say a third kind thing. But while she's determined not to say a third kind thing, a mouse comes into the cave, and the cat asks if that's part of her magic. And of course, it's not part of her magic, and she is does not want the mouse in the cave. And so the cat catches it for her, and so she is forced to befriend the cat after all. But the cat still says that he is only going to walk alone. He, unlike the other animals, he does not call the humans friends. And so then the man comes home. And the man says, what's this cat doing here? And the wife tells him what happened. And the man says, okay, you can stay if you catch the mice. But the cat snobbily says, yes, but I'm still the cat that walks alone. And so then the man says, fine, then you know, I'm 3 out of 5 men will throw things at you when they see you. And then the dog says, wait, I haven't said anything about this. And so he tries to make a deal with the cat also. And the cat again refuses and says that he's the cat that always walks alone. And so the dog and the cat also do not get along, even because the cat once again refuses. And so that is how it is. So the cat keeps his side of the bargain too. He'll kill mice. He'll be kind to babies when he's in the house, just as long as they don't pull his tail too hard. But when he has done that, and between times, and when the moon gets up and night comes, he is the cat that walks by himself, and all the places are alike to him. Then he goes out to the wet wild woods, or up the wet wild trees, or on the wet wild roofs, waving his wild tail and walking by his wild lone.
It's such a great description of what outdoor cat's relationship with people is.
Yes, it is. It's very, very accurate.
I don't know how many indoor cats they had in the late 19th century, but that doesn't seem to describe your cat, for example.
Ginger. No, Mike. Yeah, Ginger Biscuit. Ginger Biscuit is more
He's
of a lump.
Less of a cat and more of like a throw pillow.
That's true. He doesn't walk by his lonesome, but yes, they're even so, they're still, you know, there's just something about cats where they are very different than dogs in particular, in the way that they respond to humans. And even when they're very friendly, that it's still, you still always get the idea that it's entirely on their terms, you know. So
do you think the woman in this was actually trying to not say anything nice about the cat? Like, my read of this is that the woman has tricked the cat, that she's like half domesticated the cat, just as the cat has half domesticated her.
Oh, that's I think that's a fair reading. Cause I think, she has proven herself to be very clever with all the animals all along and knows exactly what they want. And so, yeah, I think that's an entirely fair reading of this, that she's playing the cat as much as the cat is playing her, and there is some sort of a balance between their cleverness in the end.
Which ultimately maybe is just what domestication is.
Yeah, there's a little, I guess in any sort of domesticated situation, you know, there is that give and take that has to happen. And so, yeah, you're right. It's maybe the most accurate picture, you know, more so than than the man or the cow or the dog, you know, maybe the cat represents best, what domestic life is really like and the give and take that is there.
I say this is my favorite one. I don't know that I have a huge amount to say about it. Like I think it's interesting that women are the agent of domestication. They're the ones who domesticate all the animals, and also they domesticate the man first. That's the first animal domesticated by the woman is the man, which does seem correct.
Yeah, I feel like that goes all the way back. I mean, if you want to go way back in the archives, the first episode we ever did together was about Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. And I feel like it was way back then that you first brought up this idea that, you know, in most of the fairy tales and things that the woman is the agent of domestication, you know, and you see it with, you know, Snow White domesticating the dwarves, of course.
You've heard what she does in the new movie, right?
I haven't.
She refuses to clean for them, and instead she teaches them to clean their own house.
Yeah. Okay. Well,
sisters are doing it for themselves.
Yeah. Teach a man to fish. I guess. I don't know.
All day in the literally working in the mines. I feel like, you know, she's at home. Maybe she could keep the house clean for them while they're out working with their hands for 10 hours a day. That's all I'm saying. I mean, I believe in Sheriff George, but I mean, get real. What's she bringing to this relationship?
Yeah, I've done my best to block all knowledge of this this new
I'm Snow obsessed White movie, with how so. Bad it looks. Like I probably will never see it. I've never seen any of them, but as someone who has hated the very idea of these live action movies, hence the name of our show.
Yes.
It really fills me with a shameful joy to see it crash and burn so hard. If only there were some sort of German word for the feeling.
Schadenfreude.
All right, we got one more story. The butterfly that stamped. This might be the funniest of the stories.
Yeah, and this one I also loved. Like this one is also, you know, number one or two, and I guess all three of these last ones that we've been talking about are all, you know, one, two, or three for me probably. So I love this one as well.
So this is a story about Suleiman bin Daoud, which is to say Solomon. So this is about King Solomon from the Bible, but it's written in the style of the Quran, so that's why it's using the Arabic name for him instead of the Jewish or Christian name. So this is the King Solomon we're all familiar with. We know he's very wise. We know he's very generous. We also know that he's married to 1,000 wives. Turns out he doesn't actually want to be married to that many women. He really just loves the one wife, but this was just the thing to do. And so he has the one wife he really loves, the beautiful Balkis. And he's got these many other wives whom he kind of married because he has to, and now they're kind of all unpleasant. He also has a special ring on his finger that if he turns in a particular direction, a whole bunch of genies will show up and do whatever he wants them to do. One day he's sitting out in the garden and he hears these two butterflies talking. And one of the butterflies is trying to convince the other one, his wife, that he is a great butterfly with a lot of power. And he says, if I just stamped my foot, Solomon's entire palace would immediately vanish, and I would have to stamp my foot to bring it back. And this cracks Solomon up. He thinks this is the funniest thing he's ever heard. So he calls the male butterfly over and has him land on his finger. and says, you know that this wouldn't, you know that this wouldn't happen. You know it's not true. Why are you telling your wife such a ridiculous lie? I love this. The butterfly looks at him and says, O king, live forever. She is my wife. And you know what wives are like. So Suleiman bin Ayyid smiled in his beard and said, yes, I know, little brother. So the butterfly returns to his wife, and the wife is like, oh, Solomon heard you. What did he say to you? And the butterfly tells his wife, he told me to make sure that I don't do it because he needs the palace right now. It's actually really important. So he asked me to please not stamp my foot and make it disappear. Well, a few minutes later, Balkis, the Solomon's wife, calls the lady butterfly over and says, why are you letting him tell you this ridiculous lie? And the lady butterfly says, look, I know he can't actually do this, but you know what men are like. And Queen Balkis says, little sister, I know. So they've kind of come to this agreement. The next day, they hear the butterflies arguing again, and Solomon just can't stop laughing. Like it's a moment of true joy for him. It has nothing to do with his position as king, nothing to do with all the power he holds, nothing to do with his 1,000 wives. It's just the funniest thing he's ever heard, and so he can't stop laughing. And this also fills Balkis with joy, because for a moment at least, she doesn't have to worry about her husband being the king. She doesn't have to worry about his 999 other wives. And she can just enjoy it. So finally, the lady butterfly says, if you're so powerful, go ahead and stamp. And the butterfly says, oh, no, she's called my bluff. So he goes to King Solomon and he tells him what's happening. And he says, look, don't worry. I'll twist my ring. It'll bring some genies and they actually will make the palace disappear. So you go do that. You go stomp your foot. We'll have the genies disappear the palace. Then stomp your foot again and the genies will bring everything back. And that's what happens. And the palace disappears. Everybody goes into like a mysterious blackness. And when the butterfly's wife sees that he has made the entire palace disappear, she tells him that she will always obey him. She'll always do whatever he says, as long as he'll bring the palace back, because now she's terrified of his power. And so he does it. But more importantly, Solomon's other 999 wives are all terrified. And they go to Balkis. And she tells him this. It is nothing, O queens. A butterfly has made complaint against his wife because she quarreled with him, and it has pleased our Lord Solomon bin Dayid to teach her a lesson in low speaking and humbleness, for that is counted a virtue among the wives of the butterflies. Then up and spoke an Egyptian queen, the daughter of a pharaoh, and she said, our palace cannot be plucked up by the roots like a leek for the sake of a little insect. No, Solomon bin Dayid must be dead, and what we heard and saw was the earth thundering and darkening at the news. Then Balkis beckoned that bold queen without looking at her, and said to her and the others, come and see. They came down the marble steps, 100 abreast, and beneath his camphor tree, still weak with laughing, they saw the most wise king, Suleiman bin Dayid, rocking back and forth with a butterfly in either hand. And they heard him say, O wife of my brother in the air, remember after this to please your husband in all things, lest he be provoked to stamp his foot yet again. So we have tricked the wife of the butterflies, and we have tricked Solomon's other 999 wives, and Solomon and the butterfly and Balkis are going to live happily ever after. And when Solomon asks why, how she became so wise, she says, first, O my Lord, because I loved you, and secondly, O my Lord, because I know what women folk are. This might be one. You're right. It might be better than the cat and the crab.
Yeah, it's so I'm a sucker for these types of stories, these, you know, kind of extra biblical but using the biblical characters, you know, like whatever that genre is. Maybe we should discover if there's a book of those, because that would be fun to go through.
Fan fiction?
Yeah. I guess you could call it that. So I'm a sucker for those already, but I love this one because the part of the story that you didn't tell there at the beginning is that at first Solomon was using his power to try and show how great he was, and he got embarrassed because he was going to feed all the animals in the world, and then this huge animal came out of the sea and ate everything that he had prepared, and he realized that he actually had overstepped what he was capable of, and because of that he was being a little he didn't want to show off his power towards his wives. And so Balkis, she had to go through all this trickery because Solomon wasn't going to do it himself. He was kind of in this place of realizing his need to be humble. And so there's a way in which he was able to preserve his integrity, but also what needed to be done got done. it's kind of fun.
Yeah, I did leave that out. Sorry.
No, that's okay. This is, I think it's just, it's a very clever story, how can somebody remain true to themselves, but also, justice can be done in some way, I guess, if you want to call it justice. I don't know if you want to call it justice. Maybe justice is too strong a word, but the whole idea was that the wives were making his life miserable, and he had no recourse against them. So Balkis had to plan this so that he would have some recourse.
It takes a wife to catch a wife. What I love about it is it's a story supposedly about the benefits of wives submitting to their husbands, and it's really about a woman manipulating her husband for his own good and for hers. Like it is a happy ending, like a legitimately happy ending. If Solomon really didn't love these other 999 women and just had to be married to them, like it's kind of excellent that Balkis is able to trick them all into keeping their mouths shut.
Right. And I think there's also a little bit of like going back to like what we loved about the crab in the sea story. It's the joyfulness and the playfulness of Solomon that reveals his true, might and power and strength as a king, instead of his just coming down hard on them and stamping his own foot, so to speak. It's out of his play and out of his joy with these butterflies that that the solution is found, which I thought was very lovely.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great way to end the story set. I really think the second half of this book, we certainly had more to say about it than we did about the first half. But I really think it's backloaded with some of the best stories.
Yeah.
And absolutely. The alphabet one, which nobody but me likes.
Yeah. You and that one critic. I wish I would have found his name, but oh well. C'est la vie.
Well, this was a very brief series on the Just So stories. What are we doing next, Josh?
Well, Michael, we are going to try and attack the Arabian Nights. And there are actually three volumes of Arabian Nights. So it's a lot. So we're not going to do all of them. But Michael and I have gotten the first volume of the ones put out by Penguin. And we're going to look at that first volume, and we're probably going to take a month off here just to get our heads around it. These would be unfamiliar stories for both of us, and obviously from a different culture. So you can expect us back first week of June, and we'll be getting to discuss the Arabian Nights. And I'm really looking forward to that.
And we'll have to look and see. I don't know how it's set up. So it might be that we do something more like what we did with the Grimms, where we're just picking a few to do instead of doing all of them. I've never read the Arabian Nights, and I just ordered the book. So we'll make that decision as the time draws near. But it works really well to move on straight from The Butterfly That Stamped, which has a very Arabic character.
Oh yeah.
Into Arabian Nights.
It's like we planned it.
We don't plan anything.
That's true, but it's nice when it works out. Because of our own playfulness, everything worked out.
It's just joy.
Yeah, it's pure joy. All right. Well, it is a joy to be with you each month. And our press liaison is Christian Filipic. And you can check us out on the old interwebs at christianhumanist.org. You can help us continue this conversation by reaching out to us at beforetheywerelive@gmail.com. And we also want to encourage you to set your podcast player's dials to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, where you'll find a bunch of old shows and us. And Christian Humanist Profiles still puts out some shows. And City Man occasionally has some new shows out there. So anyway, there's stuff out there for you.
I also wanted to say, Josh, that it's not on our network, but David Grubbs has a new podcast.
Oh, really? I did not know this.
Yeah, he and his friend Christian Lightheart are reading through The Fairy Queen, which I will not be joining them in. But if you are interested in joining them, you can get the show Of Knights and Pilgrims wherever you listen to podcasts. And I think, unlike us, they do that as a video, and you can watch the video on YouTube.
Wow. All right. Good plug, Michael. And I learned something. So that's awesome. Cool. Yeah. So everybody go rush over and check that out. Michael and I know there are a great number of podcasts out there you could be spending your time on. So thank you for spending the time with us. So for Michael Farmer, I'm Joshua Almanchofer, reminding you, crab babies hate being taken out of their hidden holes and brought home in pickle bottles. And that is why they nip you with their scissors, and it serves you right.